Is this where it began? The threats to school board members, the kidnapping plots on elected officials. Did it all start with the lock her up meme of 2016? Coming up on the United States of Anxiety, conservative columnist Mona Charon talks about what she calls perverted patriotism and about the future of conservative politics. Are you a conservative who just can't get down with the authoritarian streak running through the Republican Party today? We'd like to hear from you. Also, we got an interesting observation from one of you who was at the Capitol on January 6th. We'll share what you noticed about the crowd and ask a researcher who's been tracking prosecutions what it means.
The vast majority were, for lack of a word, pedestrian in nature. They're realtors in Texas, they're construction workers in Pennsylvania, they're soccer dads in Missouri.
That's coming up on the United States of Anxiety.
What would you consider a patriotic act?
I have no idea.
Me neither.
Representing, like, where you come from?
It depends on what patriotism is perceived as, right? It's nice when people are proud of their country, but I think when patriotism is seen as exclusive, then I think it's not really patriotism anymore.
Would you consider patriotism a good or a bad thing today?
I guess more negative side.
Patriotism is never a bad thing.
I don't feel like it is a good thing at all. I would like to distance from that term completely.
It seems people who are patriotic go towards like a nationalist extreme.
It's an abused term used to justify things that are wrong in your society.
White supremacy and white power.
It's a really good way to get people to do what you want them to do without them questioning it, because it's unpatriotic.
I wouldn't go around bragging that I'm a patriot. Sorry.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Patriotism, in the most literal sense, is quite a mundane idea. Merriam-Webster says it's love for or devotion to one's country. In our political culture, it's been a similarly straightforward and familiar divide for a long time. A clear embrace on the right, a more distant relationship to the idea on the left. But somewhere along the way, those familiar signposts of national politics went a new direction. On the left, some have begun trying to rebrand patriotism around liberal ideas for the country's future. And as for the right, I am not yet sure what to say about where we've arrived, which is why we've invited Mona Charon to join us on this show tonight. Mona has been writing a syndicated column about national politics from a conservative point of view since 1987. She began her career at the National Review, which was certainly the journal of record for conservative thought at the time, at least. She was also a speechwriter for Nancy Reagan, among many other claims to fame. And today she's policy editor of The Bulwark and host of the podcast Beg to Differ. And Mona, thank you for joining us tonight.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Okay, so Mona, let's start with the latest viral video horror, which has been circulating this weekend. I don't know if you saw this story, but it's a video of a woman in Page County, Virginia, at a school board meeting where they're debating whether to continue mandating masks in schools. Here's the clip.
All right, no mask mandates. My children will not come to school on Monday with a mask on. All right. That's not happening. And I will bring every single gun loaded and ready to, I will call every.
Okay. That's 3 minutes. You've gone past your time. It's a policy. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll see y'all on Monday.
The woman later said she did not mean this threat literally, that she was talking figuratively about opposing a mask mandate with all her might. I should also say that the board ultimately voted to end its mask mandate, which is in compliance with the new Governor Glenn Youngkin's executive order giving parents the right to choose whether their kids wear masks at school. Also, that the local sheriff's department has charged the woman with a crime for making this threat. Now, Mona, I won't ask you to comment on the facts of this case, as you may or may not have followed it, but I feel like the incident in general offers a lot of openings for our conversation. You know, one thing that strikes me is that there is an actual specific policy dispute at the core here. It's not solely culture war posturing, but what, if anything, about what you have heard there from her and in that scene stands out to you?
Oh, it's just, we're so used to this by now, aren't we, Kai? You have people you know, for example, there's this youth group called Turning Point USA, run by a guy named Charlie Kirk. And at their most recent meeting, somebody stood up and said, because they were circulating the big lie about the election having been stolen, and this perfectly sincere man stood up in the audience and said, look, you know, when do we start using our guns? When do we start killing people? And Charlie Kirk, his response was kind of pathetic, but he said, we're not recommending that because that would just be playing into the other side's hands or something along those lines. Not, that would be immoral and wrong. We don't call for political violence, But in any event, this is the mood that has been engendered by many things over the last 5 years, primarily Trumpism. But the kind of hysterical resort to violent imagery and violent talk and even violent actions, as we have seen on January 6th, has unfortunately become part of our political culture. And it is unclear what the future holds now that this Pandora's box has been opened.
Yeah. You wrote about this Pandora's box in a recent column. And you pointed to useful stats from the Washington Post that lawmakers were subjected to 3,900 threats in 2017, which already sounds like a lot to me. Mm-hmm. But in 2020, that number shot up to 8,600. So that's more than double. And it rose even further last year. And you said you've heard from Republican officials, or heard of Republican officials in particular, who are genuinely afraid for their safety if they go against the grain. Is that hyperbole? I mean, what are they saying?
No, that is so. In the beginning, when in 2015, if you will, when Trump was running, and there was this bully boy tone that his acolytes adopted, particularly Roger Stone and others. At the time, it simply took political courage, the courage of one's convictions, to stand up against Trump. But in the intervening time, with pretty much lightning speed, it is now no longer that you have to have political courage. You have to have physical courage, because the threats to people's safety are absolutely real. And they are, everybody who has done the right thing, for example, regarding the election of 2020, if you look at, and frankly, things could have been much worse had it not been for a number of Republican local officials, state officials, and others who refused to lie, refused to misrepresent the results, did their jobs, showed integrity, right? And it's amazing how many of them have either been rebuked by their local Republican Party, removed from office, or had death threats. Many of them had to leave their homes because of the threats to their safety. Members of the U.S. Congress were afraid to vote for impeachment in 2021, the second impeachment, because of fear for their families. They knew they would they would confess. That they knew Trump was guilty, and they knew, they would like to, or perhaps like to have voted for impeachment, but they were afraid. So yeah, now we've reached the point in America, which I never thought I would live to see, where we are becoming more like the countries around the world that we used to instruct about democratic process, rule of law, peaceful transitions of power. And now we're coming to resemble them. It's deeply, deeply worrying.
You have some personal experience with this. Back in 2018, you were on a panel at the CPAC conference, which is, the annual gathering of conservative politicos and thinkers. And by that point, your opposition to Donald Trump was well known on the right. But you've also long been a critic of today's feminist politics. And as I gather, you wanted to make a point about hypocrisy, that as conservatives, you have to stand up to abusers in your own ranks if you're going to have the credibility to challenge what you see as the excesses of progressive feminists. So, yes. So you did make that point. And what happened to you?
Well, So I did make that point, and I was booed because I was saying that you cannot ignore the sexual abuser in the White House, and you can't ignore the fact that the Republican Party endorsed a known or strongly suspected, let us say, child abuser in who was that Senate candidate from Alabama, Roy Moore. And so that was in 2018. And I said, this is you won't, as you just quoted me, you won't have credibility and you can't. And besides, you cannot. I mean, it's so easy to always criticize the other side. But frankly, as everyone knows, when you criticize your own side, you have more credibility than when you're criticizing the opposition. It's nothing easier than criticizing the opposition.
Right.
But it's important to criticize your own side. And by the way, I have to say, some of the most gratifying letters that I received at the time were from people who said, you know, thank you for doing this. I've been a lifelong progressive or liberal, and I hope if the tables were turned, I would have the integrity to do the same thing to my side.
But you had to be escorted out by security, right? I mean,
I was escorted out by security. Yes, I was. although, you know, maybe that was excessive caution on their part. Who knows? But yes, I was escorted out by security. I mean, I was dumbfounded because they said, you know, how were you planning to get home? And I said, well, I was just going to call an Uber, you know. And they said, well, we need to have you escorted out. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well. Let's hear from Dan in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi. First of all, for a first approximation to conservatism, look it up in the dictionary. And the first thing you'll notice is that any radicalism, left or right, automatically does not constitute conservatism. Secondly, I've been a conservative since UC Berkeley in the 1960s. And in all that time, I had no objection to opposing racism, women's rights, or any of these things. And I've been very much a participant in them. The problem is that what you have now is not what people call the right, is not conservatism, but what it really is younger generation from the democratic labor origins in terms of their parents, for whom there were no jobs available. So they went in the military, fought all over the world, and came back, and there's still nothing for them because everything keeps going to China. And these people do not have more than a high school education, so they were hoping to have the same manufacturing jobs as their parents, union protected, perpetual, living a middle-class life. There's none of that left because of everything going to China. So when you see these guys out there practicing shooting and all this, it's the only thing they've ever known. That's the only thing the country ever gave
Dan,
them,
I'm
the military service.
Dan, and I'm going to stop you there just for time. And Mona, I want to add to what Dan's saying. Basil Rodericks on Twitter asks a version of this too. What does conservative actually mean? How does Mona Charon use that moniker? What is being conserved? So
right.
Maybe I put those two things together. And what is your response?
Sure. I guess I agree with the caller that what we are seeing now on the right is not conservatism. It is a kind of radicalism. So I agree about that. I might quibble or perhaps have a different interpretation of why we got here. But regarding how I think about conservatism, here's how I think about it. I think that it is conservatism in America has always been a bit different from conservatism in Europe. In Europe, it's kind of a throne and altar kind of worldview that, you know, you like authority and you like order and you like the way things were always done and you have a sort of religious sensibility and so forth. In the U.S., of course, there are different kinds of conservatism, but the one that I was always attracted to was the one that was all about conserving the American founding. And the American founding is based on limited government, maximum amounts of individual liberty and rights for individuals. And then beyond that, the conservative worldview is one that is open to reform, but cautious. you know, and circumspect and wants to take everything into account and is very concerned about process, how you do things, the legitimacy of change, and not, you know, simply, you know, having radical departures from the way things are always done. In fact, there's an old story that that somebody said, you know, that a conservative comes, you know, sees a fence that, you know, he's on a long walk and he sees there's a fence. And instead of saying, why is there a fence? You know, oh, this fence is in my way. We really need to get rid of it. Would say, there must be a reason that this fence is here. Somebody built this fence and they must have had a reason. And so that's kind of a long way around mm-hmm. saying that I regard conservatism as being about prudence, about doing things the right way, about protecting the rights that we all love and are part of our patrimony as Americans. And finally, let me just say, it's about respect for truth. And that has been the most disorienting aspect of the last few years for me, is to see the disinformation that, frankly, as an old Cold Warrior, I associated with the KGB. Mm-hmm. But the right-wing media outlets have become purveyors of such lies. And it's, you cannot have a self-governing people who are so badly misinformed and disinformed, if you will. So that sort of is my summation of my own conservatism and you know, what I think it can be at its best.
I'm talking with columnist Mona Charon about the embrace of political violence and citizens' arrest memes on the right, and about the future of conservative politics. We want to hear from you too, particularly if you consider yourself conservative but don't feel comfortable with this trend in the Republican Party. Where do you fit in politically these days? Beyond your partisan affiliation, what matters to you, and how are you able to engage those things, if not through the Republican Party? We'll take your calls after a break. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, this is Kusha. I'm a producer. A couple weeks ago, we asked you how anxious you are about the state of our democracy from 1 to 10. Here's what one of you had to say.
My name is Electra. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'd put myself at a 9 out of 10. What worries me is a substantial minority of human beings being not just fine with, but exhilarated by very abusive behaviors that look like bullying and gaslighting. It really invites us to question, is there something about human nature that just keeps us aspiring to democracy, to see what is possible in egalitarianism and mutuality, and then nevertheless being complacent as we slide back into exploitation and kind of worry that, like, humanity just reverts to exploiting itself in minority rule over and over again. I can only hope that we keep trying to recognize that mutuality is still a possible thing.
Thanks, Electra, and everyone who's listening and talking to us too. So if you've got something to say, please send us a message to anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, the address is anxiety@wnyc.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. A programming note, I spoke with Carol Anderson about her book Tracing the History of Voter Suppression in the United States. I think it's a conversation that offers useful context for the ongoing debate over voting rights. And you can find it at the top of our podcast feed right now. It's wnyc.org/anxiety or wherever you get your podcasts. Right now, I am talking with conservative columnist Mona Charon, policy editor for The Bulwark and a mainstay of conservative thought and debate for decades. She wrote speeches for Nancy Reagan at one point. You can't get any more bona fide than that, I'd think. But her opposition to Donald Trump has put her well outside the Republican fold these days. And Mona, can we hear some of your backstory? We heard before the break how you define conservatism, but you know, you grew up in the tri-state area here in New Jersey. You were raised by brainy academics, as I believe, right? A psychologist and a chemist who were both Democrats. So how'd you end up a Reaganite?
That's right. Well, they were part of a phenomenon that I don't think is that unusual. They were sort of mainstream, middle-of-the-road Democrats who actually, right around the time that McGovern was nominated, felt that the Democratic Party had gone too far left for them. And so they actually, though they had been Democrats, they voted for Nixon in 1972. And my family was very interested in public affairs, and we talked about everything. I don't think they quite expected me to become an actual conservative, but they were very tolerant, and the fact is, you know, one of the things I worry about is that in our current environment of such heated polarization, the thing that I get the most satisfaction from, and that I think is one of the crowning glories of our civilization, that is the process of debate and argument and hashing things out in a democratic way is under threat at the moment. And, you know, I bet that most of the listeners to this radio station have views that are far to the left of mine on many issues, and we could have strong feelings about it and arguments. There is this attitude now, not that I want to persuade the other side that, you know, they're wrong, but I want to crush them. And they want to crush me. And therefore, we have to kill each other. We have to win. We have to just make sure that they never hold power again, or the country is going down. And it makes having reasonable arguments almost impossible.
But I have to ask about that. I mean, I don't know about the listeners to this radio station, but certainly, you know, I'm probably many miles left of you. And you know, people like to say, right? Like conversations like this one we're having, two media types with very divergent political views, used to be normal and never happened. But I'm not sure, does that really ring true? I mean, we had the Point Counterpoint TV shows, but I mean, was there really substantive, and I mean this as a question, I mean, in your experience, was there really substantive sort of cross debate where people changed their minds even in a bygone era?
Yeah. No, look, I mean, it's a really big subject. And, you know, I would refer people to Jonathan Haidt's book about how people, I forgot the title right now, but anyway, he wrote a really good book about how people make up their minds. And it's actually, there's a lot of tribalism that goes into it. And a lot of the time we think we're being, motivated by a good argument, but in fact, our emotions go first. And, you know, so there's a lot of research about that. But I would say that, that the tone of hatred, the feeling of hatred that is now dominating on both sides is definitely new. There was always a certain amount of mutual distaste, let's say, but it was still possible, for example, in Congress for the two parties to come together and say, all right, you know, you think this and we think that, and let's come together and at least craft some kind of compromise. And that is less and less possible, although it's not impossible still. I mean, there are moments, and I think, you know, the infrastructure bill was one, and possibly, God willing, we will get one of those on reforming the Electoral Count Act. So we'll see, but it's becoming more and more difficult.
Let's hear from Elizabeth on the Upper East Side. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Well, I always listen to your show, and I come from a very conservative background. My grandfather was Chief Justice, and my father used to argue cases before the Supreme Court.
Wait, your grandfather was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? Is that what you just said?
Yes.
Who was your grandfather?
And Charles Evans Hughes.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
All right. That's well, great. But my father argued cases against wiretapping. He was also conservative, but it depended, really, we were raised to believe that it depends on the situation. Because my grandfather had a case where he argued for the socialist way back, and he wanted to be fair. And that's how we were raised, to be fair and just. Isn't that what justice is? So I don't like hearing the left view right now. I think that they're way too far over towards socialism, and nor do I like the wackos that you see on the right. You just said it. Something has happened to this country.
And Elizabeth, where does that mean for you? Where does that put you then if you're, you know, if you feel like there's these two poles and you don't
relate to them? I don't open my mouth much.
Oh, wow.
I don't say anything because you never know how people are going to react. You just don't. And there's a lot of wackos sleeping on the street. I mean, I could go into how this city is being run too, but that's not the point. I'm just saying that you can't state your mind if you're a Republican or a conservative anymore. People really react badly.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you for stating your mind to us on this show. We welcome your call, and I hope that you will keep calling.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. Very interesting family background there. And by the way, I hope you'll explore The Bulwark, bulwark.com, where I'm the policy editor.
And
we have a non-tribal approach to policy matters, and it's very lively. I hope you'll give us a try.
Let's go to Josh in Millerton, New York. Sorry, Josh. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask why you avoided in your definition of conservatism the issue of common good when the preamble to the Constitution not only talks about a more perfect union, but domestic tranquility, common defense, general welfare, and blessings of liberty to ourselves and posterity, so our kids and grandkids. And the whole idea of the common good is an equal part of the founding as well as individual liberties. And I think that should be core to conservatism if I understand conservatism. And I'll drop off here and say thank you.
Thank you, Josh. How do you respond to that?
So the caller mentions common good, and maybe some listeners aren't aware that there is a movement out there among people who call themselves national conservatives who reject the idea of limited government and do so on the grounds that they want to be, they want to pass laws for the common good. And there's a lot that goes under that umbrella. And I am not happy about that trend because it seems to me that it is, that it sort of has the potential to drive a truck over individual liberty. You know, one of the things that people cite is, you know, that there was this objection to, what was it called? The something happy hour. Oh gosh. In San Francisco, it was, drag queen story hour was called at the local library. There we go. I found it. And one of the conservatives, went on a tear about this, saying that, you know, it from his point of view, and he's very involved in this whole national conservatism thing. He said, you know, this is the sort of thing that we, you know, really need to stamp out. And it's for the common good. You know, it's for your own good. And my view is you cannot do that in a pluralistic country, that the genius of our system is we let people, to the degree possible, we let people do what they want, and as long as they're not hurting somebody else. And if you stamp out somebody's right to do, the story hour, then they, when they take power, will stamp out your right to, have religious services or to have guns or to have many things that you hold sacred. And so I think there is this, what I am worried about in this tendency is it's fierce intolerance and it's authoritarianism. It's potential authoritarianism. You have to let be content to live together in the same country with people who have views that are very different from your own.
But why do you think, so someone on Twitter, Lulu, asks a version of a question I have, which is, why do you think white nationalism has found such easy and comfortable home in the Republican Party? And I guess I would associate it with what you were just talking about as well, this stamping out of pluralism in general. Why do you think it has found such an easy home in the party?
It's always possible to appeal to people's lowest instincts. And that's one of the reasons that leadership is so important. There are reasons that we have taboos and against certain kinds of demagoguery. You know, it used to be taboo to make an explicitly racial appeal. Now, I'm not obviously going further back. It was absolutely normal, but I'm talking about in the last, you know, in my lifetime, okay? Mm-hmm. And those taboos were important. And when Trump transgressed one after another, you know, starting with, you know, I don't like John McCain, you know, the hell with heroism, you know, I'm not for heroism, you know. And then, of course, with the, you know, the racial and the ethnic and the rest of it, you know, he transgressed all of these norms. And again, you know, to use that same metaphor, he's letting this genie out of the bottle. These tendencies toward racial hostility, toward ethnic suspicion, toward all kinds of hatreds are always out there ready to be exploited. But a country that is has a healthy political culture strongly discourages that and even makes it taboo, as I was saying. And when we repealed the taboo, it's not shocking that we're getting a lot of it. And it's just galloping along. And frankly, one of the things that I find so dismaying is also just the sheer vulgarity of the age we're living in. The fact that "Let's go, Brandon" is chanted at football games in the South, you know, at college football games in the South. That's just disgusting. And
the idea that a metaphor of bringing guns to make your point at a school board meeting is so casual, even if it was meant, meant as a metaphor and not literal.
No, exactly. So, you know, the guardrails are down and all the sewage is flowing out, if you'll forgive the mixed metaphor.
Well, I don't know. That's about right. So in the couple of minutes we've got left, Mona, in your column, you argue that your prescription to this is what you call more uncorrupted patriotism from everybody else. What do you mean by that phrase?
Right. So I lament the fact that the people who are supporting Trump and who are supporting these, so sorry, my dog is barking in the
background. It's okay. He's welcome on there. They got something to say. We just want to hear him out.
Is that, you know, these people who are making citizens' arrests and threatening local school boards and so forth, they think they're the patriots. And of course, they're the opposite of patriots because they're not respecting pluralism. They're not respecting rule of law. They're not respecting the fact that other people have different views. And therefore, you know, how do you answer that? Well, we have to have a better patriotism. And it's important for people who still hold, like our earlier caller, Elizabeth, you know, people who still hold to the old standards of what it means to be a patriot, to speak up and say, you cannot hijack patriotism from me.
Do you think this is unfair to ask with a minute left, but what is the prospects of a third party for people like yourself and Elizabeth?
Well, of course I would welcome it, but it's awfully difficult to form third parties in the United States. And if there are clever people out there who've looked into it and have some great ideas, I'm open to it. I'm also open to changing the way we vote with ranked choice voting, as you did in New York. I'm open to all kinds of reforms because I think we are sliding. We are really sliding.
Is there any real conversation about another party amongst your colleagues?
Oh, there's lots of conversation. But as I say, there are just all of these institutional barriers. And then there's also the right-wing ecosystem of information that's out there makes it extremely difficult because you have this hardcore of about 30% of the Republican Party that, you know, that is in charge and that gets oxygen from the Foxes and the Breitbarts and the rest, you know. So it's really, it's a difficult situation.
Mona Charon is policy editor for The Bulwark. She's been writing a syndicated column about national politics from a conservative perspective since 1987. Thanks so much, Mona.
My pleasure, Kai. Great to be with you.
Welcome back. I'm Kai Wright. Regular listeners know that one of my favorite parts of this show is hearing from you. I'm always asking you for emails and for voice memos, and that's for a reason. A lot of times they inform what episodes we make, and sometimes we like to just go through the mail and tell you what we've been hearing. Though, if I'm honest, the we in that is really our senior digital producer, Kusha Navidar. Hey, Kusha.
Hey, Kai. Yeah, after each episode, we get emails, voicemails, video. Here are some that we thought everyone might find interesting. First one is in response to our solstice episode last month. We asked how you at home celebrate the solstice, and a listener named Ricardo, who, full disclosure, is actually a friend of mine, sent us a video of him outside safely burning a fire.
A fire.
You said you wanted an icebreaker for this segment, Kai, and I took that literally. Here it is.
There you go, all frustrations. Consumed in fire. A new year is coming.
Yes, Ricardo, burn it all. Burn it down. Kusha, that sounds just really satisfying to put your anxiety in a fire and burn it off. And, you know, I mean, it's felt like, as I've talked to callers over the past several months, that a lot of people are actually struggling with how to react, how to show up in this moment, politically, socially, in every other way. And it, you know, it makes me think about the conversation we've just had with Mona Charon about finding new ways to think about patriotism in this country.
Yeah, it's interesting. After one show, we got a voicemail from someone saying she's been trying to keep fighting for the country she wants to live in, but she's kind of worn out.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle. I am in Texas. I was responding to the prompt about how our engagement with politics has shifted. I graduated college last May. I would work for campaigns. I was studying government and political communication. I don't want to say it's almost the complete opposite now, but it's close. You know, graduating and really kind of taking a look at the world I was graduating into didn't give me a lot of hope. Like, what can I actually do to make change when these systems have been in place for so long? We know what's wrong, and yet the same things keep happening with racial justice, with the environment, with COVID. It just feels a little bit hopeless. And I've been trying to kind of engage at more of a local level. And I think that's been helpful because it's a little bit easier to identify things that you can change and your vote means a little bit more. I really appreciate the perspectives and the guests that you guys bring on. So thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you, Gabrielle. And then one more for you, Kai, and this one was surprising. A couple months ago, you remember we did an episode called The Myth of the United States, and we talked about how division has always been a part of our country's history. After this episode, our inbox was full. We got one voicemail from someone who had an interesting observation about what happened on January 6th.
Hi there. My name's Henry. I was especially struck by one of the last comments on your segment on, you know, we fought a civil war in the 1860s to prevent the Union from breaking apart, and now we might have to break apart to prevent a civil war. And for me, that actually is a really appealing concept. Like, as someone who does worry about the prospect of political violence, I mean, there's a large portion of the country that, though I think they're wrong, that believes that this past election was stolen. And if you actually believe that, then something like January 6th, it's hard to say that that's not warranted. I'll say I was actually there on that day. I was actually in the crowd in an observational capacity, not at all aligned with it, but had shown up. And so I was there out, you know, outside the Capitol, but watching it unfold, and it was terrifying. But there were a lot of militia, there were a lot of crazy people, there were also a lot of what we would largely consider to be normal people who got carried away in something that they actually believed was right, was the right thing to do, was to stand, like, they thought that they were reliving 1776.
Henry's observation made me think of a research project underway right now. The Program on Extremism at George Washington University has been tracking the details of every federal prosecution of people who stormed the Capitol that day. I met the deputy director of that program recently, Seamus Hughes, and he was explaining to me what they've been finding in those court documents. So I got in touch with Seamus, and I played Henry's message for him. Seamus, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you heard our listener Henry's characterization of the crowd he saw that day. Just what's your reaction to what he said?
I think he hit the nail on the head. When you look at the cases, so we've got more than 1,000 people that the FBI has been looking at who crossed a legal threshold onto the Capitol. Of that, 720 people have been charged federally for crimes that day. And the organized groups, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, they get a lot of media coverage because they were all in uniforms and stack formation, had their radios and things like that. But if you kind of dive into the numbers, the vast majority were, for lack of a word, pedestrian in nature, kind of a typical profile, right? They're realtors in Texas, they're construction workers in Pennsylvania, they're soccer dads in Missouri. They weren't part of organized groups by any means. They come from 46 different states in D.C., the vast majority of them were kind of live streaming their own crimes in real time. And so the takeaway from this is there was obviously some organization and some pushing by politicians and others. But for the folks that were there, they largely came there because they saw kind of a Facebook post about it or a tweet about it. And were drawn to this idea of we've got to stop the steal.
And why does that matter? Why is it important to understand that?
So in many ways, it's a little bit more frightening. And in other ways, it's not. So here's the way it's more frightening. So the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, they were always going to go January 6th, right? But if you can get the soccer dads from Missouri, you can get a kind of a mass movement towards there, for lack of a better word. That is concerning in and of itself. In fact, when you look at the folks who have assaulted police officers, individuals who have been charged with assaulting police officers, the vast majority of them were what we call spontaneous clusters. So they attacked a police officer with someone they met with that day. They were kind of wrapped up in the fervor of the crowd of that moment. Now, that's the concerning part about it.
Yeah.
The place that we can take a little bit of solace for is we haven't seen a huge mass movement like that since January 6th at the Capitol, right? So January 20th, the inauguration, or the Justice for January 6th rally in the fall. The folks that are going to those rallies now are the true believers through and through, and less to be kind of the, again, those soccer dads from Missouri.
And why is that? Why is it not those people anymore?
Because the full weight of the federal government jumped in. I mean, this is the largest FBI investigation in its history, the largest DOJ prosecution in its history, the most cases the DC federal courts has ever taken on. And so you're not getting the merely curious, for lack of a better word. Now, the concern is it's still not an insignificant number of people that are drawn to this, right? The Oath Keepers still have membership in the thousands, right? The Proud Boys have still been active in a number of states. So things are still churning along. The hope, and I'm not sure whether my hope is misplaced. My hope is kind of social media companies, which played a role in terms of their algorithms pushing someone down a rabbit hole, may sit up and take notice a little bit more than they did in the past. Because if they don't, we're going to have another moment like that.
What about that? I mean, one of the stats that you point out as you go through these cases, that 77% of people charged were charged based at least in part on evidence taken from personal social media accounts. And you've actually warned that, like, we shouldn't just be mocking that, that it's not just an example of like, oh, well, they're pretty bumbling criminals there, that it is, that's actually a worrying fact. How so?
It's much more worrying for me because, you know, it's not that they're bad criminals, although they are, right? But it's really more so that they didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They thought they were part of a second revolution. And if you're going to be part of a new republic, you want to document your victories, which makes prosecutors' jobs a whole lot easier when you're facing evidence and images and videos. But it does speak to a larger question here, which is no one thinks they're being a traitor. No one walks in thinking I'm Benedict Arnold that day. They all thought they were patriots. And they thought that if they didn't do this, they were going to lose their republic. And so that feeds into this hero narrative, right? This idea that if I don't go there, no one else will, and I am just the man or woman to do so. And so, in many ways, it's really almost more concerning.
You have been involved in national security and counterterrorism work in Washington for a number of years on a wide range of movements and issues. How does what you just described? How does that compare to other threats and other terrorist movements that you've studied in the past?
In many ways, you're looking at kind of a mini mass radicalization. I would be hard-pressed to think of an event that would garner that many people for other extremism movements in recent history. Now, you got to put it in context. We're talking about a couple thousand people in D.C. on that day in a population size of 300 plus million people. So context matters. At the end of the day, though, they did cross threshold, get to the Capitol, and stop certification for a number of hours. So I'm not minimizing it, but in the larger scheme of things, relatively small numbers. Now, let's put it in a different context, which is you look at domestic terrorism or domestic extremism in the U.S. You have 1,000 active investigations in all 50 states for ISIS or Al-Qaeda cases. You have 2,700 active investigations for domestic terrorism. So that's neo-Nazis, white supremacists, that type of movement. In the last year and a half, that number has gone from 850 to 2,700. So the FBI director is kind of keep sounding the alarm in commercial testimony. He says, our agents are overworked. We're moving folks off of ISIS cases, also off of white-collar crime cases, off of public corruption cases, and we're moving on to domestic terrorism because the threat is rising to a level that we cannot handle right now. They're asking for more resources, more prosecutors. They're throwing everything at that because they haven't seen anything before like this. Mm. One last thing I noticed, you look at the extremism landscape in the U.S., it's fractured, meaning that you don't just have white supremacists, you don't just have neo-Nazis, you don't just have incels or sovereign citizens or a whole host of ideologies which are quite confusing and esoteric in nature. Mm-hmm. They kind of mix, right? It's a kind of a salad bar, as the FBI calls it, a salad bar. People are picking and choosing their own stuff. And so that becomes a little bit harder for law enforcement to kind of wrap their head around. You add into the fact that they're Americans with their own civil rights and civil liberties protections on top of that, rightly so, and that becomes a very hard problem set to address.
I saw somewhere, it may have been you, that talked about it as a potentially massive networking event, that there was all these disparate ideologies and people that got together that could potentially then make it a more coherent movement. So has that turned out to be true, or has the opposite turned out to be true?
I think the opposite right now, but we got to look at the buildup to January 6th. The buildup to January 6th, you look at rallies in Virginia and Washington and California for a variety of issues, whether it be kind of quarantine lockdowns or gun rights or things like that. The same players that were there in Virginia showed up on January 6th. And so clearly there was some level of coordination, or at least kind of nodding that you saw somebody at the crowd last month. And that does matter a great deal. Now, they weren't trading business cards in the middle of the attack. But there is something to be said about, for lack of a better word, a rock star status that comes with being there on January 6th. Mm. And we see a number of these January 6th defendants pivot away from remorse and feeling of guilt for being there and instead use it as a kind of bona fides to start businesses or podcasts or all of these things, because they were the ones who, when push came to shove, they showed up that day.
You are a sober guy, a careful thinker, you're a researcher. Where are you on a scale of 1 to 10 of your level of concern about this extremism?
Yeah, so I've been doing this type of work in national security for the last 20 years. So I perpetually end up at a 5 at all times. And I think that's probably a safe way to go so I can sleep at night. For this, I'm probably more at a 6 or 7, right? So
oh, wow.
There are things to be hopeful for, which is the fact that there wasn't mass rallies after January 6th in any real way in the Capitol. The other thing is, we should also notice, you know, post January 6th, there was not a major terrorism attack in the last year. And so that is a victory. And we can decide whether that's because the threat has gone down or whether law enforcement's been more active. I think the jury is still out on what the answer is for that, but there's something to be hopeful for. We also need to look back on our history. Right? Think of the 1970s of car bombs going off every couple of days for a variety of different extremism movements. We have ebbs and flows of extremism and terrorism in this country, right? Every once in a while, we can pull ourselves back. And I get a sense, and this might be the forever optimist and the, you know, first generation immigrant of me, but I think to myself, we're going to be able to figure this out. That's for the violence part. For the question of kind of echo chambers and radicalization and kind of generally not wanting to be in the same room as somebody who doesn't have the same politics of you, that's really more where I'm more concerned. The societal ills of this and less of the violence, the mass violence.
Seamus Hughes is the Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. Thanks for taking this time.
Thanks for having me.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Mixing by Jared Paul. Milton Ruiz was on the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Emily Botine, Regina Dehir, Karen Froman, and Kusha Navadar. And I, of course, am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at @Kai_Wright. That's @Kai_Wright. And you can join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. Stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, take care of yourselves and thank you for listening.